All right, everybody, it's 12:59 and the recording has started. So I'm going to kick off today's training webinar with some an introduction and a house and some housekeeping rules. So on behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I'd like to welcome you to today's training, ITRC's 1,4-dioxane science characterization analysis and remediation. My name is Devin Sechkar. I'm your moderator today. This training is an introduction to the online ITRC guidance document of the same name, ITRC 1,4-dioxane, and was produced by ITRC in 2021. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Some housekeeping for today. As I stated, this training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through CLUIN for those not able to join us live. The CLUIN training page that brought you here to our webinar today offers the slides available for download under Download Training Materials. Please use the Q&A box to ask questions, make comments, or report any technical problems at any time. We will have two question and answer breaks, the first about halfway through our modules today, with the second at the end. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the feedback form and click a box to certify that you participated in today's training, a certificate will be provided to you. The feedback form is also available on the CLUIN training page that brought you here today. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, the federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website where you can find out more about the teams that are available for registration and how you can become an active member. ITRC's full disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. With that, I have the pleasure of introducing Lauren Larkin from the Minnesota Department of Health to get us oriented on an introduction of 1,4-dioxane.
Hi, thanks, Devin, and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Today's training is based on the ITRC 1,4-dioxane team products. We've developed six fact sheets as well as a 2021 guidance document. So these will be referred to during the training, and they're all available on ITRC's 1,4-dioxane website. Our training modules are based on the fact sheets and corresponding sections of the guidance document. So this training is going to be a six-part modular series focused on history of use and potential sources, regulatory framework, environmental fate, transport, and investigation strategies, sampling and analysis, toxicity and risk assessment, and remediation and treatment technologies. So if you want to refer back to this training later, you can find a copy of the recording and the slides on the CLUIN webpage, which is referenced at the bottom of the slide. And I think Devin's going to drop that in the chat for you guys. So as mentioned, ITRC has a 1,4-dioxane website, and that link, it's not showing up at the bottom of my screen, but we'll put that in the chat as well, the link to the website. So our team has developed the fact sheets and guidance document to address questions and guide practitioners in best management practices when managing sites where 1,4-dioxane is present. We've developed these tools for multiple user groups, including the public. So in particular, the toxicity and risk assessment fact sheet was created to address common questions the public has about 1,4-dioxane and its risks. So ITRC initiated the 1,4-dioxane team in 2018 to review the information and science of 1,4-dioxane. As a little background to start, 1,4-dioxane has been used as a solvent stabilizer since the 1950s. So these solvents were used widely through the 80s, which suggests 1,4-dioxane's presence at thousands of solvent sites in the U.S. However, it hasn't always been a standard compound in typical analytical suites. So in the past, it's often been overlooked. So why do we care about 1,4-dioxane? Well, The EPA has classified 1,4-dioxane as likely to be carcinogenic to humans. Some states have devised standards or regulatory guidelines for drinking water and groundwater, and these are often sub-part per billion values. These low values present challenges for analysis, characterization, and remediation of 1,4-dioxane. So our team's created multiple tools and documents that provide information to assist all the interested stakeholders to understand this contaminant and to make informed, educated decisions. So we encourage you to use the ITRC 1,4-dioxane products and these training modules to learn about 1,4-dioxane and how you can apply these best practices at your sites. So just as a reminder, as Devin noted, if you do have questions, please place these in the Q&A box, and we'll discuss them during the question and answer session that we'll have midway through and then at the end of the training. So now I'd like to introduce our first presenter, Bill DiGiuseppe, a principal hydrogeologist at Jacobs with more than 35 years of experience overall and almost 25 years dealing with 1,4-dioxane. So he'll be presenting the module on history of use and potential sources of 1,4-dioxane. Thanks, Bill. Take it away.
All right. Thank you, Lauren. Appreciate it. Let's make sure I'm taking into account the lag time. Okay, so for the learning objectives in the history and use section, we're going to provide an overview of uses and help you identify potential sources of 1,4-dioxane. We'll provide an understanding of the history of 1,4-dioxane manufacturing and usage, which again could tie into building your conceptual site model. And then we'll provide a case study of a sort of typical 1,4-dioxane and chlorinated solvent co-located site. So that you can see the relationships between those. As far as uses, as Lauren said, the dominant usage of 1,4-dioxane, about 90% of its usage overall, was in solvent stabilizers, chlorinated solvents, and I'll go into that. But there are a raft of other uses in the medical world and polyester manufacturing and paints and coatings and adhesives, all different kinds of things. At the bottom of each slide, there's a notation about what section of the ITRC guidance document contains additional information, section 1.2 in this case. And if you want even more information, Tom Moore compiled thousands of uses of 1,4-dioxane. But the key takeaway really is that the manufacture, usage, and release of dioxane is tied to 111 trichloroethane, 111 TCA specifically. And understanding that relationship and the history helps you understand where you might find 1,4-dioxane relative to activities at a given site. So one initial question you might come up with is, why is 1,4-dioxane needed to stabilize solvents? As those chlorinated solvents decompose, they form various acids, and those acids cause reactions with the metals that are being degreased or plated, and it can cause quality issues and poor adhesion of the plating materials. So the stabilizers are used to address those acids. And there are different types of stabilizers typically used for chlorinated solvents. There are acid inhibitors, which make it so the acids don't form, acid acceptors, which neutralize the acids, or what are called metal inhibitors. It deactivates the properties of the metal surface and makes it so that the damage doesn't occur. So 1,4-dioxane is dominantly used as a metal inhibitor. Another question that comes up frequently is, was 1,4-dioxane used as a stabilizer in TCE, trichloroethene? And there is evidence that trichloroethene has been stabilized for various vapor degreasing applications for a long time. There isn't really any documentation that 1,4-dioxane was that stabilizer used. And again, Tom Moore had collected a lot of information about 1,4-dioxane usage as a stabilizer. He found extensive documentation, patents, and other information about dioxane being in 111 TCA, but really scant documentation for it being in TCE. And one of the issues is those early formulations of TCE as a degreasing agent they're kind of vague patent literature. They didn't describe in detail like they do nowadays. And one reason why they might not have had stabilizers, 1,4-dioxane as a stabilizer, is that TCE is substantially more stable than 111 TCA. So it doesn't break down as readily and doesn't quite need as much stabilizing. In the end, it may not really matter, because in practice, what we see in the field at many sites is an association between TCE and TCA, different solvents used at different times. And so it may not really matter, frankly, which solvent dioxane might have been used with. So I'm going to discuss the production history of 1,4-dioxane kind of in chunks of time and discuss it relative to chlorinated solvent production and usage as well. So the first time is from 1863 through 1973. 1,4-dioxane was first synthesized in 1863. Everything that's in blue on these figures, by the way, relates to 1,4-dioxane. Everything that's in green relates to chlorinated solvents. So production began in 1929 in a limited way and a much more commercial scale production in 1950. And then production increased over time through the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s, early 70s of 1,4-dioxane as industrial activities increased as well. And chlorinated solvents, manufacturing began in 1920 or so, and dioxane was first documented to be used as a stabilizer in TCA in the late 1950s, and chlorinated solvent usage increased rapidly in the 50s, 60s, and 70s as well. And then kind of in the early 70s, late 60s, awareness of the hazards of TCE, the toxicity, led to a number of people switching to 111 TCA, which was thought to be less toxic at the time. So there was kind of an increase in TCA usage and a decrease in TCE usage. So the next time block is from 1973 to 1990. There's limited data available, couple data points, and shows some variability over time, which may kind of be an artifact of the data we have. But overall, a maximum in like the mid-1980s, 1985, kind of the maximum 1,4-dioxane production period, 25 million pounds a year produced. And again, 90% of that was used for solvents, and TCA production also peaked around that time at just under 900 million pounds. And then post-1990, there was a decline from 1990 through into the 2000s, 2010, 20s, whatever, that era. And it was down to basically about 1 million pounds a year. So dramatic decline in the 90s. And there are a number of reasons for that. One is chlorinated solvents were identified as a problem, specifically the Montreal Protocol designated 111 TCA as an ozone depleter. So that was sort of taken out of production for the most part. People quit using it as much. Other regulations and information came available. CDC and ATSDR suggested that TCA only be used for limited essential applications. And then in 2012, the EPA initiated sampling for 1,4-dioxane under the UCMR3 unregulated contaminant monitoring rule number 3 to understand how widespread 1,4-dioxane was in drinking water in the U.S. And they published a drinking water health advisory in 2012 as well. And Jana will go into much more detail on that. Whoops, wrong way. So then as far as a case study, this is a specific example of where 1,4-dioxane and chlorinated solvents were used and co-located. This is Air Force Plant 44, a missile manufacturing plant in Tucson, Arizona. TCE was used from the 1950s, more or less into the later years as only minor uses. They mostly use aqueous degreasers, detergents now. But they have a very well documented switch from dominantly using TCE to dominantly using TCA around 1974. And there are a number of sites that were impacted by chlorinated solvents. The degreaser solvent waste went into unlined lagoons at Site 3, which operated from the mid-60s through the late 70s. And then Site 5 had wastewater sludge and metal sludge from the plating shop as well. And that also was 60s through the 70s. There is a groundwater pump and treat and reinjection system that has operated from 1987, more or less through today. And in this figure, you can see the co-location of the red chlorinated solvent plume, that's the TCE plume, and the purple 1,4-dioxane plume. One of the unusual things when it was discovered, this is sort of the map at the time of discovery, the dioxane plume was bigger than the TCE plume because this pump and treat system had several interceptor rows of wells. Each of those sort of gaps in the TCE plume are where wells were truncating the plume and cutting it off. but then the water was being re-injected into the aquifer on the outsides to push the plume towards the center, and it was not being treated for 1,4-dioxane because it was an air stripper system, and as Francisco and Fritz will tell you, it doesn't strip very well. So when it was initially detected, the dioxane plume was actually bigger, wider than the other plume, but that has now since narrowed. But it does show the co-location, and one interesting thing, the other little red TC plume over here was from releases that were earlier, 1940s and 50s, or into the early 60s. And so no one switched over to TCA, and it was dominantly TCE usage without dioxane co-located with it. So that's kind of an example of that. Key takeaways for history and usage is dioxane was used in a lot of different industries, hundreds of different industries, but primarily associated with 111 TCA, and its manufacture and volume of release and everything else is tied to 111 TCA as well. It may have been present in TCE, but there's really no direct evidence of that. However, there's an association, as you just saw, between TCE and 1,4-dioxane, even though it was dominantly in TCA. And then what you might commonly find is co-location of dioxane with chlorinated solvents, pretty common, and oftentimes at about the same order of magnitude and same location. So now I'll turn it over to Janet Anderson, who is a principal toxicologist at GSI Environmental with over 15 years of experience, dominantly working with emerging contaminants, both dioxane and PFAS, of course. Take it away, Janet.
Thanks, Bill. Hi, everybody. Let's see if we can get started. So as Bill said, I'm going to be talking to you about the regulatory framework and landscape for 1,4-dioxane. We're going to focus on the primary state and federal regulatory programs that are relevant to 1,4-dioxane, mostly in the environment. And the importance is to recognize that we actually do have regulatory and guidance values for 1,4-dioxane in groundwater, drinking water, soil, air. So we'll walk through some of those. So interestingly, even though 1,4-dioxane is often called an emerging contaminant, it's actually regulated across a wide array of programs across both federal and state level. Shown here are some of them that there are current existing regulations for 1,4-dioxane. I'll only be highlighting a few in this training, but for more information, you can go to section 2 of the guidance document. I'll be talking about mostly the regulations that are relevant to environmental and human health protection. So starting at the very beginning, the manufacture of 1,4-dioxane. Here in the US, manufacture to include the manufacturing, import, processing, distribution, use, and disposal is regulated by the EPA under the Toxic Substances and Control Act, or TSCA. TSCA was amended significantly in 2016, and 1,4-dioxane was identified as a priority chemical, one of the top 10 priority chemicals under the re-evaluated or amended TSCA program. And so accordingly, EPA issued the first draft of their priority chemical risk evaluation for 1,4-dioxane in June of 2019. That evaluation was for risk to workers and occupational non-workers only. And so it was during that industrial and commercial conditions of use. It did not include any other conditions of use. Interestingly, then what happened was in November of 2020, based on some public comments and discussions sent to EPA, they issued a supplemental risk evaluation, and the whole thing was finalized at the very end of December in 2020. Though final risk evaluation included then an evaluation of risk to the potential to the general public as a byproduct in some applications of consumer products. Via surface water exposure for surface water that was near manufacturing plants. So it looked at both swimming, incidental ingestion, and fish consumption if for the fish near those surface water near the manufacturing plants. It did not evaluate risk from drinking water exposures. So the final conclusions of the December version is that December 2020 version. EPA determined there was no unreasonable risk to the occupational users or non-users or to the environment from that scenario. No unreasonable risk to the general public from the specific conditions of use related to the consumer products that they looked at. No unreasonable risk to the general public due to surface water impacts near manufacturing, but there might be an unreasonable risk to workers in the domestic manufacturing, processing, and industrial use if PPE wasn't appropriately utilized. In January 2021, the Executive House, the White House Executive Order was instituted that requested the federal agencies reevaluate determinations that had been recently made just to ensure that they followed the best science. And EPA announced it was reevaluating the 1,4-dioxane risk evaluation conducted under TSCA. And a draft of that has been released, and we're waiting for that to be finalized. So let's talk about occupational protection and what kind of standards we have under occupational standards. Those exposure scenarios of concern are in the occupational setting is air. We do have some air standards. They are fairly outdated and old. So the American Conference of Government Industrial Hygienists, often called ACGIH, has an 8-hour threshold limit value. California probably has one of the more recently updated values under their OSHA program, also an 8-hour weighted average value for occupational settings. And we also have some ceiling limit recommendations and acutely dangerous or immediately dangerous to life and health standards from NIOSH. What about the use in pharmaceuticals and what's the regulation there? Well, currently in the US, there are no regulations explicitly for 1,4-dioxane in cosmetics and pharmaceuticals. So those products are regulated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. They do have a recommended maximum limit of 1,4-dioxane at 10,000 micrograms per liter in any one cosmetic product, but no explicit limits in pharmaceuticals. 1,4-dioxane is classified as a class 2 solvent by the agency, and so there are daily exposure limits just in general for class 2 solvents and pharmaceuticals. Personal care products is a hot topic. At the federal level, again, EPA's TSCA concluded there were no unreasonable risk for those specific conditions of use they evaluated in the December 2020 version of their risk evaluation. Several states, however, have moved ahead and have issued various forms of either product labeling and reporting requirements or actual limits of 1,4-dioxane in consumer products and personal care products. So under California's Prop 65, 1,4-dioxane is listed as a chemical known to cause cancer to the state, which requires then any kind of manufacturers or distributors within the state to have a warning label if the exposure exceeds 30 micrograms per day. Also, California's Clean Products Right to Know Act requires a disclosure if it's above certain limits as well. Similarly, and probably most notably in New York, most recently passed a bill for personal care product limits for 1,4-dioxane that prohibits the sale of personal care cleaning products with 1,4-dioxane levels that exceed 2 parts per million as of December 31st, 2022. That level will go down at the end of this year to 1 ppm. And New York's going to reevaluate that threshold based on best available science every 5 years. And then a small number of other states have very similar kind of reporting acts, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, et cetera. All right, well, what about surface water? So surface water is regulated here in the US by EPA's Office of Water under the Clean Water Act. We currently don't have any surface water quality criteria for 1,4-dioxane. If you go into the ECHO database, the Enforcement and Compliance History Online database, you can find several National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permit languages that include monitoring requirements for 1,4-dioxane. And there may be some site-specific limits or set requirements that may vary across the state and, again, would be site-specific. But at the national level, there's no enforced surface water quality criteria or effluent limitation guideline. Several states do have certain surface water quality standards that they've set for the chemical, including wastewater discharge permits. At the environmental cleanup level, so for restoration programs, 1,4-dioxane is listed as a CERCLA or RCRA hazardous substance, and we do have screening levels. So we call those the regional screening levels, or the RSLs, issued by the EPA regions. We have screening levels that we can use to screen impacted sites, groundwater, soil, or air. Shown here on the screen are the cancer risk levels at 10 to the minus 6 for residential exposure. And so as you can see, we do have a way to screen impacted sites. And then those screening levels may also serve as sort of the preliminary remediation goals or the starting place for setting remediation action levels. Shown here is a map that actually, if you go online to the guidance document, it's hyperlinked. And so you can click on each state and it should direct you to the state-specific information. I do want to caveat, we put this together in 2020, 2021. So always encourage you to go to the authoritative state guidance to ensure these numbers are still accurate and correct. And apologies if any of the links are no longer working. But last time I did go to the map myself, it is still really valuable and a lot of the links are still really functional. What we see here shown in the green and yellow and I guess maybe orange too, are the cleanup programs at the state level for 1,4-dioxane in groundwater that's potable. So assuming someone's drinking that groundwater. You can see that those values range from 0.3 to 200-ish micrograms per liter or ppb. The most recent states that have passed numbers for groundwater protection have been in the single digits, so 4 or 9. Those states have set those values reflecting a 10 to the minus 5th cancer risk level. And again, we have those residential RSLs I just have again here on the slide for reference. More information about all of these state numbers can be found in the guidance document, both in Section 2 and Appendix A. All right, drinking water, that's regulated in the U.S. Under EPA Safe Drinking Water Act. We currently have no maximum contaminant level or MCL for 1,4-dioxane. 1,4-dioxane has been identified as a candidate contaminant list chemical since 2008. So EPA has been looking at occurrence levels under the unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, as Bill had mentioned, and we do actually have a health advisory for 1,4-dioxane, which I'll show on the next slide. But the most recent information that I think EPA has issued was back in 2021. They have not yet determined whether there would be a meaningful opportunity for public health risk reduction, which is a requirement for setting an MCL. But they are continuing to evaluate potential health risks and exposure. As I mentioned, we do have a health advisory, though. So this level is a guidance value meant to help inform managers of public water supply systems. It was first issued in 2012 for 1,4-dioxane, and it set at 35 parts per billion, which represents the 10 to the minus 4 cancer risk level. As far as drinking water goes, we do have a few states that are also looking at either setting regulations or have guidance values. So New York was the first state to issue an MCL for 1,4-dioxane back in 2020. Their MCL is at 1 microgram per liter. New Jersey has a proposed MCL that's working its way through their regulatory process at 0.33. California is in the process of evaluating the toxicology and setting up. Their first step is the public health goal. So we anticipate perhaps next year, early next year, we might see some movement from California. And we also have Health Canada. They have a maximum allowable concentration, or a MAC, which is their federal essentially equivalent to an MCL. That was recently finalized and passed at 50 micrograms per liter. So that kind of concludes our whirlwind tour of these regulations. But in summary, we do have regulations for 1,4-dioxane, specifically exposure limits and guidance values that can help us at contaminated sites. Those are available at the residential or at the RSL, EPA RSLs, including for residential exposure. And we have a host of different drinking water guidelines or regulations, and the difference and the reason for the difference I'll talk about in the toxicology section. So with that, it's my honor to turn it over to Dave and Monica.
All right, thanks, Janet. So this is Dave Adamson, I'm from GSI Environmental. And I'll start off and hand it off to Monica as we go along. We'd like to start off here. We're just gonna show our learning objectives. Just a second here. So this is our roadmap for what we're gonna talk about within this section. So first off, we're just gonna look at those key physical chemical properties that distinguish 1,4-dioxane, as well as the fate transport processes that are relevant for it, particularly compared to other things you might find with it at a contaminated site. We use those as our basis for developing general conceptual site models for 1,4-dioxane. And finally, we're going to wrap up then talking about site assessment strategy for this compound. The guidance document doesn't have a separate site characterization section, but we felt like it works really well in terms of talking about this with respect to fate transport. Okay. So fate transport, you know, why is this important? What we're really talking about when we talk about fate transport is you know, how does 1,4-dioxane move in the environment? What happens to it while it's moving? So this is a real technical basis for making decisions about 1,4-dioxane, like where we're going to look for it once it's been released, how to evaluate the potential for risk, and the basis for making those treatment decisions, which we'll hear more about later on in this training session. So the characteristics for 1,4-dioxane, we sort of can put those into these two broad categories. It's the physical chemical properties of 1,4-dioxane itself, things like its solubility, and then the characteristics of the site. So, you know, the groundwater velocity or other hydrogeologic properties. End up being the components for our CSMs, for our conceptual site models. We have learned a lot about 1,4-dioxane in the last few years. Our knowledge is really still evolving. So what we're talking about here is really our understanding of it, of what was happening at the time that this guidance document was developed. Okay, so what are those critical characteristics? We've got one slide on that here, the really top line important stuff. The ITRC guidance has a lot more on this, but these are the real things to sort of highlight. So first, we've got this fact that it doesn't really want to partition to organic carbon. So when it's present in an aquifer matrix, it's not necessarily going to bind strongly to those soils, which means it's also going to readily leach to groundwater. Secondly, it's miscible in water, pretty much entirely solubilized. Third, it's a common co-contaminant with chlorinated solvents, and Bill already touched on that as to why. It's got a low Henry's constant relative to those common co-contaminants, so that impacts its volatility, as we'll talk about in a second. And then, as Monica described in quite a bit of detail, is that it's got degradation pathways, but they involve oxidation, which makes it somewhat different compared to those compounds it might otherwise be associated with. Another way to look at this then is to sort of compare those physical chemical properties directly, those parameter values, to those compounds that, you know, you might be more associated with, or you might expect to find at these sites where 1,4-dioxane is present. So you're looking at this table. This is also table 3.1 in the guidance document. So each of those columns represents a different compound with 1,4-dioxane. They're highlighted in red. Then you've got these various rows showing those properties. And you can see the comparison. So, you know, for example, as we said before, 1,4-dioxane is a miscible compound. So that corresponds to a solubility there in that first row of 1,000 grams per liter. About three orders of magnitude higher than you see for some of those other co-contaminants. Similarly, you look at that Henry's law constant. It's describing the tendency of a compound to partition to air after it's already been dissolved in water. So that's about three orders of magnitude less than some of those other compounds. So we'll talk about this in a little bit in a second when we talk about volatilization. It's also worth highlighting those KOC values. These are actually log KOC values versus those other compounds. So a log KOC there of 0.54 means that for 1,4-dioxane, that's an order of magnitude or more lower than some of these other compounds. KOC, again, it's a measure of the compound's tendency to partition to organic carbon that might be present. So having a low value is just another reflection how much 1,4-dioxane would prefer to stay in water when it's present in the environment. Okay, well, let's look at a basic conceptual site model for 1,4-dioxane, you know, once it's released in the environment. For any contaminant, we typically use these CSMs to lay out the relationships between different, you know, potential sources, how they're transported in the environment, and then the relative migration to different receptors. So this is a figure, again, this is in the guidance document. It's figure 3.3. It's a good, you know, starting point for discussing these different processes in this training. So we'll go through each of one of these individually. I would like to point out that, you know, this is, again, a generic CSM. It doesn't necessarily represent all the things that might be relevant at any particular site. But our group, the ITRC group, thought it was a good starting point for representing what we feel like is important for considering for 1,4-dioxane. Okay, so starting off with volatilization. So a volatilization, it's you know, inherently one of these sort of non-destructive processes where you're just talking about the transfer of a compound from a liquid phase to a gas phase. So in this case, for 1,4-dioxane, it tends to not be a real big issue if you go back to think about those physicochemical properties. It's related to its desire to stay in the water. So it's got a relatively low Henry's law constant. It doesn't meet EPA's definition for volatility based on that constant. It does have a somewhat higher vapor pressure. In that case, then it means that, you know, got these releases where, you know, there's no water around or limited amounts of water. So maybe you've got dry surfaces or maybe it releases a pure phase. That's where the vapor pressure comes in and maybe is a more important dictator of whether it's going to move to those air phases. Those are probably fairly limited types of scenarios based on how this is 1,4-dioxane is generally released. But that is a potential concern. But again, these are non-destructive processes. Next up is photodegradation. So it's sort of a catch-all term of different destructive processes that occur in the presence of light. So this might include contaminants that have been released to the atmosphere. 1,4-dioxane can undergo photodegradation. It's not a direct reaction because 1,4-dioxane, it's not really an absorber of UV light. It just really doesn't have the structure, the functional groups that would allow that to happen. So instead, what happens is that 1,4-dioxane undergoes what's called indirect photolysis. So you've got hydroxyl radicals, that's that little OH with the dot by it. When those are produced naturally in the presence of sunlight, those can then react with the 1,4-dioxane. So that's a radical species. It's a first order dependence on the relative concentration of that radical species. So the reaction is going to be faster when there's a lot of it around. It's going to be slow when it's not. So if you sort of look at, you know, literature reports on how much of the hydroxyl radical that might be present in sort of expected ranges, you might see 1,4-dioxane photodegradation rates on the order of a few hours to a few days. We've also got plant uptake on this slide. That is a potentially relevant process for 1,4-dioxane. Plants like to take up a lot of water, and 1,4-dioxane likes to be in water. This has led to a lot of interest into things like phytoremediation as potential, you know, site management type of an approach for 1,4-dioxane. And so we'll talk, that's also discussed within the guidance document. You've also got this instance where if it's being released then from these plants into the atmosphere, where the photodegradation comes back into play, because any of that would be subject to photodegradation. Okay, next up is sort of infection, dispersion, and dilution. So these are tend to be fairly important processes for something like 1,4-dioxane. Infection is simply just sort of the movement of a compound due to the bulk movement of a fluid. So a typical example, what's shown in this figure is 1,4-dioxane transport in groundwater. We've got it moving in response to maybe a hydraulic gradient. For 1,4-dioxane, since it's dissolving into groundwater pretty readily, and it's not sorbing strongly to organic carbon that's present in those aquifer solids, it can be a pretty big deal. So there's no real mechanism for sort of saying resistance to 1,4-dioxane relative to groundwater flow. So it has the potential to migrate at relatively similar velocities to groundwater. If a 1,4-dioxane plume is expanding due to these sort of processes, advective processes, you might see some dispersion and dilution as well. Dispersion in groundwater tends to be a relatively minor process, maybe more of a consideration once the plume gets pretty far out there, may make its way to surface water body. A discharge of surface water is a potential issue given one-for-doxane migration potential. So that's depicted on this slide as well. One way to think, though, about advection is sort of set up an example. And so that's what I'm going to do over these next couple slides. So we're going to talk about sort of a hypothetical release of chlorinated solvents in 1,4-dioxane at the same time. So this puts it in a little bit more context. And we're going to ask ourselves the questions, how far would 1,4-dioxane be expected to migrate in groundwater relative to those chlorinated solvents that may have been released at the same site? So the key considerations when we're asking these kinds of questions is sort of thinking about, okay, what are the physical chemical characteristics of the contaminants? What are the characteristics of the aquifer itself? And then timing of the release becomes a real key here. You've got 1,4-dioxane that may have been released with some of these compounds, but the use and release of chlorinated solvents that weren't stabilized with 1,4-dioxane may have also occurred at the same site. Okay, so let's set this up here. We're going to consider possible plume sizes at a site where we've got two different releases. So we've got a 1955 release, and that's up top, where TCE is released. And then we've got down at the bottom, a second release in 1970, where 111 TCA was released with 1,4-dioxane. In this case, we're going to assume a groundwater velocity. We're going to do a simple sort of 1D transport calculation where we conservatively assume that there's no degradation occurring within the plume. So this is going to give us an estimate of sort of how far each compound would be expected to travel by a particular year. And we're selecting 2020 in this case. And then we can look at a range of FOC values. So what's looked at here at 0.001, 0.0001. And see how that influences the R values, the retardation factors. So those are shown in the parentheses behind each of those compounds that may have been associated with each of those individual releases. All right, so that 2020 travel distance, let's look at the first one, the 1955 release. We can see the maximum travel distance, it's out near 1,300 feet, particularly for 11-DCE. That's a breakdown product, a potential breakdown product of TCE. So in aquifers where you don't have a lot of FOC, it's not necessarily going to see much retardation of that particular compound. So you could see things out near that expected sort of groundwater velocity-based plume size. Let's look at the later release then, okay? And so 1,4-dioxane transport, it's sort of out there at this 1,000-foot mark, and that sort of shaded area, it isn't very big because the retardation factor for 1,4-dioxane, it's not sensitive, that sensitive to the FOC values. So that's where the 1,4-dioxane plume comes out to. It's really just reflecting the groundwater velocity in this particular case. You'll see that distance for 1,4-dioxane is actually pretty similar to some of those chlorinated solvents, particularly those that were associated with the 1995 release. So in part, that's just reflecting that those have had 15 years longer within the aquifer, so they've gotten a little bit of a chance to get ahead in there. But overall, you're sort of seeing in some of these particular cases, you might see plume lengths for 1,4-dioxane that might be relatively similar to those co-occurring chlorinated solvents. All right, and last process that I'll discuss before turning it over to Monica is matrix diffusion. And this is sort of a new topic for 1,4-dioxane. When we say matrix diffusion, we're just talking about the movement of dissolved 1,4-dioxane from permeable soils within an aquifer, so something like sands, into less permeable materials, something like a clay or maybe a silt or a rock matrix. Diffusion is going to occur naturally. It occurs in response to concentration gradients. So that's shown in the plume portion of this, where you've got those sort of arrows moving contaminants in and out of those low K zones, depending on the concentration gradient. Once the contaminant's diffused into those lower K soils, it can be harder to get out. It can contribute to longer-term persistence at those sites where it's relevant. It makes it harder to treat, and that's one of those considerations then when you're relying on something like an injection-based technologies that'll be discussed in more detail later. So this cartoon lays this out in a couple of panels. So it's just illustrating again how matrix fusion might work or influence how mass is located over time. So think about the early stages of release. You might have 1,4-dioxane mass mostly in this sort of higher K zone where it was released. So that's that red blob. But since the concentration could be pretty high initially, you've got a pretty strong concentration gradient that's going to drive 1,4-dioxane into those lower K zones via diffusion. So that's the process shown in those red arrows. Once it's in the low K zones, advection rates are really slow, so that mass isn't necessarily going to go or get flushed out of there very quickly. So it's essentially getting stored up over time. As you move into later stages, you know, maybe once you've got around to a site investigation, we've got sort of a different situation. You showed this in this panel on the right. The concentration in the overlying transmissive zone has sort of dissipated or depleted. And now you've got a reversal in that concentration gradient. So you see those arrows going back up so that mass is diffusing out of those low K zones back into the transmissive zones. It's going to be a relatively slow process because this diffusion is slow. So this back diffusion out of these low K zones, it can serve as a long-term secondary source of 1,4-dioxane concentration at sites where you've got these sort of hydrogeologic conditions. We've got a lot of heterogeneity associated with the subsurface conditions. So it can make identification, delineation, and treatment of these sources more difficult. There's something you are going to want to consider in your conceptual site model if you've got these sort of heterogeneous conditions and something that you might need to include in that CSM, you've got the site data to back it up. All right, well, now I'm going to turn it over to Monica to discuss biodegradation and site assessment.
Thanks, Dave. Okay, so next up is biodegradation. And this is a process where there's been a substantial shift in our understanding over the past decade, because 1,4-dioxane was historically perceived as resistant to biodegradation, but we now know that biodegradation is possible under the right environmental conditions. And so this is important because biodegradation is a destructive process. So 1,4-dioxane is not necessarily going to persist forever once it's released into the environment if the conditions are favorable for biodegradation. And importantly, as discussed further in the remediation component of this training session, favorable conditions for biodegradation can be engineered if they're not already present. So as Dave mentioned earlier, 1,4-dioxane is biodegraded via oxidation reactions. And this process is mediated by a variety of organisms that have been identified, and further identification of relevant organisms is likely in the coming years. There are a lot of groups working on this. So this last point on the slide regarding the availability of oxygen is key. So while some compounds may be biodegraded via oxidation using either oxygen or alternate terminal electron acceptors, each of the currently characterized pathways for 1,4-dioxane biodegradation are dependent on monooxygenase enzymes. And these enzymes require dissolved oxygen. So importantly, this means that the conditions that are suitable for 1,4-dioxane biodegradation are different from the strongly reducing conditions that are suitable for biodegradation of the primary chlorinated solvents that 1,4-dioxane is associated with at many sites. And as such, an understanding of redox boundaries is important for predicting where these different biodegradation processes are likely to occur, understanding 1,4-dioxane fate and transport in the context of mixed plumes, and characterizing natural attenuation or designing other remediation strategies as discussed further in the remediation training section. So while each known 1,4-dioxane biodegradation pathway is mediated by monooxygenase enzymes and requires oxygen in the first degradation step, both metabolic and co-metabolic degradation are possible. So when the transformation of a constituent results in carbon and or energy yield to the microorganism, the process is termed metabolic biodegradation. And metabolic degradation is dependent on the 1,4-dioxane concentration in that concentrations must be high enough to meet the microorganism's demands for energy and growth. And concentrations that are likely to support metabolic degradation are generally thought to be on the order of hundreds of micrograms to milligrams per liter in groundwater. And as illustrated here, an organism called CB1190 is the most widely studied organism capable of metabolic 1,4-dioxane biodegradation. And microorganisms may also degrade 1,4-dioxane as a side effect of targeted degradation of other constituents and as a result of the low specificity of some of those monooxygenase enzymes for their primary substrates. And this process is termed co-metabolism. So co-metabolic biodegradation of 1,4-dioxane has been documented with degradation of primary substrates that include tetrahydrofuran, THF, propane, toluene, butane, and ethane. And ethane is particularly an interesting co-metabolic substrate because it is a product of the complete reductive dechlorination of some of those chlorinated solvents that 1,4-dioxane is likely to occur with. And notably, in the co-metabolic case, since 1,4-dioxane is not acting as a carbon or energy source, the rate and extent of degradation is largely controlled by the presence and concentrations of the primary substrates rather than by the concentration of 1,4-dioxane. Finally, on the topic of 1,4-dioxane biodegradation, it's notable that microbial inhibition is a potential concern. So co-occurring chlorinated solvents and metals, for example, copper, have been demonstrated to be inhibitory under some conditions. And there are multiple inhibition mechanisms hypothesized for these constituents, as described in greater detail in the guidance document. But this is certainly still an area of active research. So at this time, our advice is to consider the potential for inhibition on a site-specific basis and keep up with scientific advances on the understanding of this process. So moving on from fate and transport processes, the next topic in this module is media. So this graphic summarizes the primary media as well as the relative priority of each based on where one would expect to find 1,4-dioxane and to a certain extent, what might be the risk drivers. And let me reemphasize that these are relative priorities and some sites are obviously going to differ. The guidance document actually has a table that provides further detail and rationale on this prioritization. So based on what we talked about thus far, it shouldn't be a surprise that groundwater is a high priority given 1,4-dioxane's properties. And surface water is also considered a high priority because of the potential for discharge from groundwater and also because there are cases where direct discharge of 1,4-dioxane from wastewater treatment plants or other sources might occur. And this is a potential concern if surface water is used as a drinking water source. Now you can see here that soil and sediment are ranked as having a medium priority. And this is because the sorption of 1,4-dioxane is generally limited, and therefore it's not expected to persist in these media. However, since 1,4-dioxane may come into direct contact with these media during a release or after discharge, there is some potential for 1,4-dioxane to be present, and it should be considered on a site-specific basis. Indoor air and aquatic and terrestrial biota, on the other hand, are ranked as a low priority. So as we mentioned before, it would require a fairly specific set of circumstances, including elevated concentrations and complete vapor intrusion pathways to drive risk in this media. And risk to aquatic and terrestrial biota is considered to be low based on the lack of evidence for bioaccumulation or other toxicity drivers. And this topic is discussed in detail in the training modules on toxicology and risk assessment. So based on this understanding of prioritization of media, we've developed a framework to support decision-making for 1,4-dioxane assessment. So I want to start by noting that the flowchart presented here is an abbreviated version from that in the guidance document, and I encourage you to review that document for additional supporting details. But here we just want to start by emphasizing the highest priorities for site investigation, and that starts with the simple question, was 1,4-dioxane historically used or detected at the site? And if the answer to the question on 1,4-dioxane use or presence is no or unknown, then the next relevant question is, were chlorinated solvents historically used or detected at site? And as mentioned in the history of use module, one of the primary historical uses of 1,4-dioxane was as a stabilizer in chlorinated solvents. Therefore, where these constituents are present or suspected, additional investigation of 1,4-dioxane is also warranted. So if the answer to either of those first two initial questions is yes, then site investigation should likely proceed to development of a conceptual site model for 1,4-dioxane in groundwater, considering first where water is expected to travel, and then sampling at appropriate locations. So concentrations of 1,4-dioxane in groundwater should be compared to the relevant standard or site-specific risk thresholds. And if 1,4-dioxane concentrations in groundwater are not greater than those relevant criteria, then it's likely not a groundwater or surface water concern. However, if 1,4-dioxane concentrations do exceed the site-specific or applicable regulatory standards, then the next step is to implement additional sampling to refine the conceptual site model and understanding of site-specific 1,4-dioxane fate and transport, and then the nature and extent of 1,4-dioxane concentrations. So as mentioned in the discussion on media, groundwater and surface water are the primary concerns for 1,4-dioxane. However, we also want to take a few minutes to highlight other key considerations, specifically cases where 1,4-dioxane was or may have been released as a pure phase, cases where there's a surface water or permitted discharge, and cases with industrial wastewater treatment plants, septic, or landfill disposal. And as shown in these cases, other media may need additional investigation, including soil and or soil vapor where a pure phase might be present, surface water or sediment in the case of a surface water or permitted discharge, and any other potentially relevant media associated with industrial wastewater treatment plant, septic, or landfill disposal. So take-home messages from this section. Hopefully after hearing this discussion, you understand the key physical and chemical properties of 1,4-dioxane, and that includes low organic carbon partitioning coefficient and a Henry's law constant that leads to high solubility. You can identify fate and transport processes that are relevant for 1,4-dioxane, including advection with limited sorption in the subsurface, photodegradation in the atmosphere, and biodegradation in water where oxygen is available. From this, you should be able to start to develop a general conceptual site model for 1,4-dioxane and realize that this must reflect site-specific conditions, including low permeability zones in the aquifer that may promote matrix diffusion. And from there, you can establish an informed site assessment strategy. And existing characterization data for chlorinated solvents can help guide sampling for 1,4-dioxane, but also recognize the potential differences in 1,4-dioxane based on its characteristics. And decisions about sampling other media will be dictated by site-specific considerations, including potential sources, release histories, and the hydrogeologic setting. So with this, I will hand it over to our facilitators for the question and answer break.
Thank you so much, Monica. With that, we're going to jump right into our first Q&A session of the training today, and I'm going to look to the Q&A pod to read some questions for our trainers. All right, our first one. How long would 1,4-dioxane be expected to persist in groundwater after a chlorinated solvent plume biodegrades?
Well, this is Dave. I could give an answer, and maybe Monica, if she wants to chime in as well. It's a good question, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, people like to find generic half-lives and everything and maybe apply that to there. I would say that how long something's going to persist is oftentimes a really site-specific question, and it can matter a lot on the geochemical conditions like Monica described. So if you're in an aerobic environment, the answer is potentially a lot different than it was in an anaerobic environment. If you're in an anaerobic environment, 1,4-dioxane might persist a lot longer because it's not going to degrade. So so that may address part of that question. I'm not exactly sure if they were looking for a different angle in terms of that question. So,
yeah, I would agree, Dave, that it is really a site-specific consideration. So looking at the site-specific geochemistry and differences in the geochemistry with distances away from any sort of source area, and then also the differences in transport. So hopefully the considerations presented in this fate and transport section of the training can help you address that in a site-specific way.
Great, thank you, Dave and Monica. Next question. In a mixed CVOC slash 1,4-dioxane groundwater plume, would you expect to also see CVOCs in the low K zone, and or would 1,4-dioxane possibly persist longer in the low K zone?
Well, this is Dave again. I'll take another first crack at this. And, again, a similar question that it really is going to depend a lot on site-specific conditions for that particular one. But it is a good question, the fact that, because I didn't talk about that in matrix diffusion, is that the any co-occurring chlorinated solvents are also potentially subject to matrix diffusion. And so they would also tend to be found in a low-K zone, diffused into a low-K zone if they were co-occurring with 1,4-dioxane. The diffusion coefficients for a lot of these compounds are not really that much different, so they might diffuse that in at relatively similar rates. The magnitude of that is going to be highly dependent on the concentrations at which they were released. It's the concentration gradient that'll drive how much gets in there and then how slowly they come back off. So I guess in that particular case that the person mentioned, it would be, if chlorinated solvents were released at a much, much higher concentration than 1,4-dioxane, then maybe the chlorinated solvents would stick around in the low K zones longer and vice versa if the opposite case were true.
All right, thank you, Dave. Next question. Monica, I believe this one is for you based on the end portion of your presentation. Someone asked a clarification question. For metabolic biodegradation to occur optimally, the 1,4-dioxane concentrations, are they in the 100s or the 1,000s of PBBs?
For most reliably to occur, probably in the thousands, but there may be cases where it could be happening in the hundreds. Again, this is an active area of research, so this is just what's understood to date.
Thanks so much, Monica. All right, next question. TCE is substantially more stable than 111 TCA. Can you give some examples? Bill, I believe you'll be able to answer this one.
Sure, and Dave or Monica might also, but a good example is that case study that I presented from Air Force Plant 44. TCE was initially released at the site starting in 1950 or so, and is still present in the hundreds of part per billion, perhaps even thousands still, at that area. 111 TCA was introduced more or less to the site in the 1970s, so 20 years later. And in the 1980s, when the investigations first started, some 111 TCA was detectable. However, by the 1990s, 111 TCA was pretty much absent from the site. Its principal degradation product, 11-DCE, dichloroethene, was present, and I believe still might be present there as well. But so bottom line is TCA was released 20 years later, and disappeared 20 years earlier overall.
Thank you so much, Bill. Just to be conscious of time, we are going to have to go back to the training modules here. We will have one more question and answer at the end of the training today, and our trainers will be replying to a few of those questions that were left in the Q&A pod via typing a response. So just be on the lookout for those. All right, so next we have Elizabeth Denley with TRC to talk about sampling and analysis.
Great, thank you. Okay, so today we're going to discuss some of the sampling precautions when sampling for 1,4-dioxane, and there are only a few. We'll go over the requirements for bottles, preservation, and holding times and how they may differ depending on the chosen analytical method. And finally, there are several different analytical approaches available for 1,4-dioxane, so we're going to summarize these and discuss what the benefits and limitations are of these methods, with particular attention paid to the groundwater matrix. So when you're sampling for 1,4-dioxane in soil, sediment, groundwater, surface water, and air, most of the time conventional sampling approaches will be used. So sampling approaches, you know, are methods that you would do for most other contaminants would also apply for 1,4-dioxane. But we are going to go over just a few precautions for groundwater, soil, and equipment decontamination. So as I mentioned, you will use typical sampling methods when you're sampling for groundwater. But if you're using passive diffusion sampling, you cannot use the low-density polyethylene membranes, which are in the standard passive diffusion bags. So 1,4-dioxane will not pass through this membrane. So you're going to need to use other membrane materials or pore sizes that will facilitate diffusion of 1,4-dioxane into the sampler. So some examples of passive sampling techniques are provided here. The first two listed here are diffusion samplers, so rigid porous polyethylene sampler, and the dual membrane PDB sampler. There's also two grab samplers shown that could also be used to collect samples at specified depth intervals, the SAP sampler and the hydrosleeve. Also, one other potential issue with groundwater samples could be for low yield wells. So when this is the case, it may be difficult to fill, you know, 2 1-liter bottles, and that can ultimately affect reporting limits depending on the analytical method that's being used. But you should always check with your regulatory agency before using any specific approach to make sure that it is allowed. Again, soil typical sampling methods can also be used. There is one small precaution. So I think we heard earlier that 1,4-dioxane could volatilize from maybe very dry conditions, very dry soil samples. So if the soil samples are very dry, it's better for these samples to be collected as VOCs using the sampling procedure described in SWA 46 method 5035A with 8260 analysis, and that would reduce the potential for volatilization. And I'm going to talk in a minute about how this, you know, again, how 1,4-dioxane can be analyzed as a VOC or a semi-volatile organic compound, but with very dry soils, it may be better to go the VOC route. And right now, there's not really any specific soil moisture level that's been identified as a cutoff for this consideration. So if you're in doubt, you are safe with the VOC sampling procedures for soil. So 1,4-dioxane is a common impurity in detergents, and back in 2014, it was detected in the leachate from a widely used contamination product. So it's important to prevent residual detergent from remaining on the equipment, so make sure that you, you know, efficiently perform the necessary water and DI water rinses. There have been studies demonstrating that it's not present in some common detergents used in the field if you're using those in accordance with manufacturer's instructions. But if you use disposable equipment or you use passive sampling equipment, you're going to eliminate the decontamination step, and this will not be an issue. Okay, so 1,4-dioxane can be analyzed as a VOC or an SVOC, so 8260 or 8270. So depending on the analytical method that you choose or maybe that you're required to use, the choice of bottles and preservatives and subsequent holding times will be different. So the requirements for bottles, preservatives, and holding times for 1,4-dioxane in soil and water when analyzed as a VOC using 8260 is the same as it is for any other VOC. So use acid preservation for waters, low-level and high-level preservation for soils, and a 14-day holding time for soil and water. For 1,4-dioxane in soil and water, when it's analyzed as a semi-volatile using 8270, the same thing. So 7-day hold time for waters until extraction, 14-day hold time for soils until extraction, and same bottles for soil and waters as with any other semi-volatile organic. And for air, the same thing also. You have a 30-day hold time as with other VOCs analyzed by these methods, TO15 and TO17. So as I mentioned before, so 1,4-dioxane, it can be analyzed as a VOC or SVOC, but unlike sample collection, preservation, bottles, and holding times, we do need modifications for the typical 8260 or 8270 analytical methods. So which method we choose is going to depend on the matrix. It's going to depend on the required sensitivity or what reporting limits you need to achieve. what other contaminants may be in the sample, as well as the regulatory requirements. So choosing the correct analytical method is going to require knowledge on your part. I need to really work with your laboratory so they understand what you need and you understand what you're going to be doing to what they're going to be doing to meet your objectives. So the methods that require some discussion and the ones that we're highlighting today are the 8260 and 8270 methods. I do encourage you to review the tech reg document for more information on the other methods. But the first two rows here are for the VOC analyses of water samples. And the very first row of this table is the typical VOC analysis with no modifications. So you can see the reporting limits here from this technique, which is used for most of the other VOCs we normally analyze for, are pretty high at 200 to 500 micrograms per liter. The second row shows what happens when we modify 8260 and we add a heated purge and trap step and selective ion monitoring, or SIM, S-I-M. So since 1,4-dioxane is so soluble in water, that heated purge helps improve the ability of getting the 1,4-dioxane out of that water sample during the purging step. And the SIM improves the sensitivity of the instrument, and it allows the instrument to selectively look for the ions of 1,4-dioxane without looking for the other VOCs. So normally, the GCMS system is set up to scan between like 35 and 350 atomic mass units for the entire analysis time, which allows detection of VOCs which have ions in the range of 35 to 350. But with SIM, we're telling the instrument to scan for specific ions instead of a wide range of ions, and this allows higher sensitivity and therefore lower reporting limits. So now you're down to 2 to 5 micrograms per liter. Now, the next two rows are for semi-volatile analyses of water samples. And you can see here the first row is this is a typical SVOC analysis with no modifications. So again, the reporting limits from this technique are 5 to 10 micrograms per liter, so they're much lower than the VOC, typical VOC analysis of 200 to 500, but they might be still too high to achieve regulatory criteria. Also, we sometimes have poor extraction efficiency for 1,4-dioxane with the regular 8270 prep methods, which can result in maybe a potential low bias. The second, though, of these rows is what happens when we modify 8270 and we add SIM, like we did discuss for 8260, but we're also adding an isotope dilution technique. And I'll show you in a minute why isotope dilution is really the gold standard, but this is the most accurate way to measure 1,4-dioxane at low levels. It will be the recommended approach when you need to achieve low regulatory criteria in water samples. And then you can see for soil, the same four analytical techniques that we just looked at for water. And typically, we don't need to see down very low for soil, so the modifications become less critical. So really, any of these soil methods are okay. The VOC one that's done with all other VOCs, the first of these rows highlighted here, is probably okay for most data quality objectives. And remember, that's the one that you do want for very dry soils. Okay, so now we're going to look at some of these comments that are on the right here on the next few slides. Okay, so first, 1,4-dioxane D8, that's deuterated 1,4-dioxane, must be used as an internal standard in both the VOC and the SVOC analyses. So it's always best to use the isotopic standard that closely matches the analyte of interest when possible. So 1,4-dioxane D8 fits that purpose. So for VOCs, when it's not used as an internal standard, the resulting response factors are extremely low, and many times we have to reject those results per data validation guidelines because those response factors are so low. For VOCs and SVOCs that deuterated 1,4-dioxane, it mimics the behavior of 1,4-dioxane, and it adds a really important level of accuracy to the method when we spike in a known amount of this compound and measure its recovery. So as we showed on the previous table, that modified 8260 can be prone to interferences. So if a sample has elevated levels of other VOCs, that can interfere with that SIM analysis. So although the instrument is set up in the SIM mode to selectively look for 1,4-dioxane, those other VOCs are still being transported to the instrument. That can cause contamination of the systems that, you know, our labs kind of try to avoid. So if the sample has elevated levels of other VOCs, and the lab is doing this SIM option, they're still going to likely have to dilute the sample. So if you remember, the 2 to 5 microgram per liter reporting limit with the VOC SIM is likely going to increase because of that dilution. I've seen samples with elevated levels of chlorinated VOCs cause extremely high recoveries of that deuterated 1,4-dioxane, and I'll show you an example of that in a minute. So if you know your sample is going to have elevated levels of other compounds, the 8260 SIM may not be the best option. So isotope dilution. So the exact method of quantifying concentrations may differ between labs. There are two general types of quantification, internal standard and external standard, and isotope dilution. So three different methods. So isotope dilution is really the most accurate quantitation method. So how it works is our samples are spiked with a known amount of 1,4-dioxane D8 prior to the start of preparation. And that deuterated 1,4-dioxane goes through the entire preparation and analytical process with the sample. And the instrument is calibrated for both deuterated 1,4-dioxane and 1,4-dioxane. And when the sample's analyzed, the concentration of 1,4-dioxane and the concentration of the deuterated 1,4-dioxane are calculated. But the actual area count is used of the deuterated 1,4-dioxane is used in the calculation of 1,4-dioxane. So if the actual concentration of that deuterated 1,4-dioxane is above or below the true value, that's going to be reflected in that area count, and then 1,4-dioxane will be proportionally corrected by that amount. So this allows the analysis to account for any preparation, analytical errors, and really, most importantly, lets it account for any matrix interferences. Remember I said 1,4-dioxane can have poor extraction efficiency by those 8270 prep methods? Well, isotope dilution will compensate for that poor extraction efficiency. So again, it's really the gold standard for quantitation. Some regulatory agencies, like New York, they require the use of isotope dilution for 1,4-dioxane. Okay, so I mentioned before, I've seen samples with elevated levels of chlorinated VOCs cause extremely high recoveries of that deuterated 1,4-dioxane. So this sample has an unusually high recovery of the deuterated 1,4-dioxane, right? About 87,000%, which seems highly suspicious. Now, this sample also has high concentrations of select chlorinated VOCs. So you can see about 660 micrograms per liter of cis-1-2 DCE, about 8,300 micrograms per liter of TCE. And if you look on the far right side of this column of this table, you can see that these chlorinated VOCs have an ion in common with some chlorinated, with the deuterated 1,4-dioxane. So there's a similar ion between deuterated 1,4-dioxane and some chlorinated VOCs. And although that mass spec is just looking for the 1,4-dioxane D8 ions, one of those ions is shared with a chlorinated VOC, and it's therefore being detected and interfering with the recovery of this deuterated standard, which could elute around the same time. So a high recovery of 1,4-dioxane D8 may not necessarily be indicative of a high bias for 1,4-dioxane and may instead be due to interferences from chlorinated VOCs. So as I mentioned earlier, the use of 8260 for 1,4-dioxane really should be ruled out if you know you have elevated chlorinated VOCs. It might be lab dependent also. You might want to check with your lab if they can get resolution between the chlorinated VOCs and the deuterated 1,4-dioxane, but you could also just be safe and use the 8270 method. Okay, so I've shown before that the 8260 SIM reporting limit, if you remember, was about 2 to 5 micrograms per liter. I would be very leery of labs that say they can see down to 0.2 micrograms per liter for 1,4-dioxane by 8260 SIM. Data become really questionable when labs report down this low using 8260 SIM. So in this example, you can see here is extremely poor peak shape. It's kind of even pushing the limit if that's really a peak or just noise. And the area count of the primary ion for 1,4-dioxane is 22. That's very low. You know, with an area count of 22, it'll be virtually impossible to see a good signal for the 1,4-dioxane conformation ion, which is supposed to be about 60% of that primary ion. So this may be instrument dependent, but when you're looking for 1,4-dioxane at very low levels using 8260 SIM, scrutinize the intensity of that primary quantitation ion, ask the lab for the raw data to review it. It's really important to evaluate this in relation to your project objectives. So these are just average costs, but they're generally all the same order of magnitude. You're always going to pay probably a little bit more for 8270 with SIM isotope dilution, but again, it's the gold standard, so you get what you pay for. Okay, so which analytical method should I use? So it's going to depend on your project objectives, right, and what criteria you're trying to achieve. It's also going to depend on what other contaminants may be present in your sample, as we just talked about. You need to do a really good job of matching site conditions with the chosen analytical method. So this kind of summarizes what we've already discussed, but again, if there's elevated concentrations of other VOCs and you need low reporting limits, use one of the 8270 methods. Even if the lab does the 8260 SIM, they're still going to need to do dilutions due to other VOCs. And again, if those chlorinated VOCs are high, they may interfere with the accurate quantitation of that deuterated 1,4-dioxane, which will ultimately affect your 1,4-dioxane result. Look at how low you need to go. If you need to achieve 0.3 micrograms per liter or even 1 microgram per liter, use 8270 with isotope dilution. The only downfall to 8270 with isotope dilution is that it may typically require 2 1-liter amber glass bottles as opposed to 8260, which only requires 3 40-mil vials. So that could be an issue, as I mentioned earlier, with low yield wells. And of course, check with your regulatory agency on any specific requirements. So I'm not going to go through this flow chart, but I did want to let you know that everything we discussed today is in a flow chart in the tech reg. So ideally, you could use this to determine, you know, which analytical method will best suit your needs in the absence of any regulatory requirement. So now we're going to have a quick knowledge check, and I'll read the question. So you are sampling groundwater. Whoops. For 1,4-dioxane and need to meet the regulatory screening criteria of 0.3 micrograms per liter. Prior rounds of sampling detected elevated concentrations of some chlorinated VOCs, like cis-1,2-dichloroethene. Which analytical method will you likely need to use in the absence of any regulatory requirement?
I'll give the poll about 30 seconds and then I'll release results, which it is.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so you guys were paying attention. The correct answer is SWA468270 with SIM isotope dilution. Thank you. So that concludes my module, and I'm now going to turn it back over to Janet.
Thank you. Hi, everyone, again. Are we good? Ready to go? Okay, so now I'm going to quickly give you a summary about 1,4-dioxane toxicity and risk assessment. Learning objectives, we'll talk about the risk drivers for both human health and ecological risk for 1,4-dioxane. Importantly, we'll touch on the evolving science on how 1,4-dioxane may cause cancer and how that's impacting regulatory and risk assessment decisions. And at the very end, I'll put in a plug for ITRC's risk communication toolkit that is for emerging contaminants and is applicable to 1,4-dioxane. So first, we're going to start with human health. Human health generally can be categorized as four main steps. We ask the question, what hazards, that's the hazard identification, or what are the potential health effects that you may see associated with a chemical? And combined with the dose response, which is the classic tenet of toxicology, that it's the dose or the exposure information that dictates which hazard effects or potential health effects are of concern. You combine that with an exposure assessment. What are the exposure routes and levels that are concerned? Some of those are going to be site specific, and in certain regulations, they are set to default and protective assumptions, combining all of that into the risk characterization. So we're going to walk through the information for both human and eco, kind of following these general four steps. So first, to talk about what are the potential health effects associated with exposure to 1,4-dioxane and at what exposure levels. So first, we do have rodent studies, predominantly rodent studies, which is pretty common for industrial chemicals that we extrapolate then to inform human health risks. In the rodent studies, we see non-cancer effects associated with liver and kidney, for example, and inhalation effects, irritation to the eye and respiratory effects. But it's really the cancer endpoint that is driving the concern for human health and the risk assessment and regulatory values for 1,4-dioxane. As was mentioned earlier, EPA has identified 1,4-dioxane as likely to be carcinogenic to humans. So this information on cancer risk, as I said, comes from rodent studies. We see tumors in the rodents, both mice and rats, both males and females, in multiple different target organ systems. Generally, this is going to be the driver for human health. It's really the lowest exposure level of concern. And while all the toxicologists really should be in agreement that cancer is the predominant risk driver for 1,4-dioxane, there are some differences of opinion on exactly how 1,4-dioxane causes cancer. And that's important because we call that the cancer mode of action, and it really informs how you set the regulatory number for what is a threshold value for, say, exposure in drinking water. So for example, the US EPA has determined that 1,4-dioxane's cancer mode of action, or the MOA, is unknown. So that's well documented in several of their assessments, including their 2013 Integrated Risk Information System, or IRIS, assessment, but also in the TSCA risk evaluations that I had mentioned earlier. What this means is we use the default dose response model, which results in a determination that any increased risk or any increase in exposure, excuse me, increases your risk. And that's what we see for classic carcinogens where we have that cancer risk management range. So it then results in a range and a risk management decision of whether you want to use the 10 to the minus 6 or the 1 in 1 million cancer risk level or the 10 to the minus 4 or 1 in 10,000 cancer risk level. And so using drinking water default assumptions about exposure and human body weight, that's where you get the 0.35 to 35 part per billion or microgram per liter differences in evaluation. So same cancer understanding, a default assumption that really that evidence is we're unable to determine what the mode of action is. So we're going to use the default and most protective risk-based screening calculations. That's in contrast, though, to other agencies worldwide, for example, Health Canada, World Health Organization. Those organizations have looked at the data and have determined that the mode of action for cancer is non-genotoxic and has a threshold. So, for example, Health Canada's mode of action conclusions that form the basis of their federal drinking water standard at 50 parts per billion, they say that the weight of evidence supports a non-genotoxic mode of action for 1,4-dioxane through this regenerative proliferation-induced mode of action. What that means is that exposures up to and below that threshold, our bodies are able to handle and there's no increased risk. There's a single then line where once you exceed an exposure level, now you're at an increased risk. And so you get, that's how you, the math results in a 50 microgram per liter, according to Health Canada. So why does this matter? Well, in a lot of site-specific risk assessments, it won't matter. And a lot of jurisdictions follow US EPA, and we use the IRIS assessments. But at times, we are challenged as toxicologists and when we're communicating to stakeholders to use what we call the best available information. And we follow a standard hierarchy of toxicity information. Typically, tier one is US EPA IRIS values, tier two, EPA provisional peer-reviewed values. And tier three does include other EPA offices, but also international agencies. And EPA, in fact, has a history of relying on Health Canada's tox information. Importantly, all of that information is supposed to be based on best available information that's peer-reviewed and considered state of the science. So it's just important that you're aware of the differences in interpretation and communicate your decisions at any given site or given regulatory paradigm. So in summary, that choice of the cancer toxicity value really has a significant impact, for example, on the drinking water or on the groundwater screening level. So it can result in a difference of 0.33 all the way up to 50 micrograms per liter, assuming just use of default assumptions about, again, drinking water intake and body weight. So risk assessors need to pay attention to the latest science We do have some ongoing in regulatory decision making, like in California. New Jersey's MCL is not quite final. There are some new publications that are out that continue to support the Health Canada mode of action decision. But importantly, just be aware of the differences of opinion and ensure that your professional judgment and adequate explanation of your choice is well documented. From an exposure perspective, it's pretty easy, as really well described by Monica and Dave in their section. We're mostly concerned about drinking water exposure assessments. However, exposure analysis and exposure assessments are site-specific. And so in that evaluation at a site-specific level, it's important to characterize the exposure pathways, the magnitude, frequency, and duration, especially if we're concerned about chronic or low-level exposure and a cancer risk, like for a chemical for vinflunfraxine. So as Dave and Monica said, it's really going to be those drinking water sources, the groundwater that's used as drinking water. Vinflunfraxine is not likely to remain in the soil, so we're not as concerned about incidental soil ingestion. It's unlikely to volatilize out of the water, so it's more that sort of water persistency and water exposure route for humans that drives the primary concern for human health risk. And then finally, the risk characterization step, again, you just kind of bring it all together. So talk about the toxicity evaluation, cancer is going to be the risk driver, the selection of your toxicity values, and what exposure assumptions are used. And those are likely to be site specific. And importantly, we part of that is the discussion of the uncertainty, and that cancer mode of action discussion is an important component of that. From an ecological risk perspective, the same four steps. Generally, it's not considered, vinflunfraxine is not considered toxic to ecological receptors because it's going to be, if found in the environment, predominantly in those aqueous media. Fish are considered the most sensitive because they're likely to have that more chronic and long-term exposure. In mammals, we do see effects only at the highest levels. We're talking the 100s to thousands of milligrams per liter levels in soil. Generally, it's not toxic to plants. David mentioned that phytoremediation is even a possibility. Very importantly, vinflunfraxine does not bioaccumulate. So we don't have to worry about that trophic level transfer, that secondary poisoning, and the biomagnification or bioaccumulation of vinflunfraxine. Vinflunfraxine is readily excreted and eliminated in all vertebrate systems. We do have ecological screening levels. So again, to show just the high levels and the low concern we have for ECO, you can see these numbers in surface water, sediment, and soil in the milligram per kilogram range or the milligram per liter range. More information on these are in section 5, if you're interested in how they're derived, and more information on how they can be used. Again, the exposure assessment for ECO is going to be pretty simple. It's going to likely just focus on the aquatic route. Obviously, site-specific information is important. And so for the risk characterization for ECO, what I found in my career is generally, we can just do a screening level risk assessment, confirm the media that may be impacted and confirm the exposure levels in those media that our maximum concentrations don't exceed. Typically, that's all that's necessary. And then lastly, for risk communication toolkit plug, the website link is shown here. The purpose of this toolkit is really to help put risk assessment concepts in language that's accessible to the general public and help you walk through a decision logic of understanding potential hazards and making decisions about risk management. And so it's acknowledged that this is really important for emerging contaminants where there are differences of opinion or evolving science, different regulations. And so this could be really helpful for vinflunfraxine as well. So just in summary, the ecotoxicity of vinflunfraxine is low, not likely to be a driver compared to the human health risk. Cancer risk is going to be the primary health risk concern for human health, chronic long-term exposures. The science is still evolving, so I encourage you to watch the regulatory decisions coming up soon and the peer-reviewed published literature on the recent science. There's a lot of research still going on at the academic level about how vinflunfraxine might cause cancer. And so when you select toxicity values for a site-specific risk assessment, for example, just make sure you're using the best science and that it follows the applicable guidance, statutory requirements, and policies for your site. And then clearly communicate uncertainties, limitations. So with that, I'll end the toxicology part and turn it over to our colleagues for the next module. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Janet. I appreciate it. This is Fritz Krems with TriHydro. And now we've heard a lot about the problem statement, as it were, and Francisco and I will tell you a bit about what to do about it, the remediation and treatment. So let's get started by looking at our learning objectives. These include understanding how, when, and why different treatment technologies are appropriate, looking at the different physical properties for soil, groundwater that will play into this, appreciate the design considerations for well-established treatment technologies, and identifying when certain technologies aren't appropriate for 1,4-dioxane treatment. We wanted to introduce this figure, which you'll see over and over again today. It's also a central part of the guidance document. You'll see here that we have 1,4-dioxane groundwater plume in orange with several in situ treatment technologies listed down there. We also have some ex situ treatment technologies listed alongside wastewater treatment and drinking water treatment. We'll touch on all of these today. Today, we're using a red, yellow, green stoplight motif to show how we've categorized these technologies. Red is less effective technologies, which are those with negligible or limited capacity for 1,4-dioxane removal, either by demonstration or theoretical considerations. Emerging options in yellow may be partially demonstrated or researched, typically those that have been implemented at the bench or pilot scales. Finally, we have technologies in green that have been implemented and demonstrated under full-scale conditions, and these are typically well-documented. We'll focus primarily on fully demonstrated and emerging options, but we'll touch on some less effective technologies that could be potential pitfalls when 1,4-dioxane is present along with CVOCs. You'll also see the stoplight throughout the slide so you can quickly identify what category each technology falls into. We've also broken down the technologies by where they may be best applied in the subsurface. The purple box shows the VADO zone that includes various soil and soil vapor treatment technologies. In the groundwater plume, we have the source zone in pink with higher concentrations of 1,4-dioxane. Then we show the downgradient groundwater plume in green. Notice that each of these technologies can have application in different subsurface areas. This graphic isn't meant to be limiting. As we talk through the different treatment technologies shown here, we'll briefly describe the technology, discuss how it applies to 1,4-dioxane, and identify special design considerations. We'll keep things at a high level for today, but the guidance document gets into more details. One last thing, the little post-it note that you see on the right of the slides today will help identify when we have a case study about a particular technology in the guidance document. We'll start with the VADO zone and soil or soil vapor treatment technologies. As you heard in the fate and transport portion of the training, we've seen that there are a limited number of instances where soil or soil vapor treatment is needed for 1,4-dioxane. Typically, 1,4-dioxane will be quickly transported into groundwater. However, in instances where 1,4-dioxane was used directly or stored at a site, it's possible it may remain in the VADO zone. Also, sites located in arid environments might have residual 1,4-dioxane in soil because there's not much precipitation to transport it downward, or because the groundwater may be very deep below the ground surface. The VADO zone has fully demonstrated emerging and less effective treatment technologies. The fully demonstrated technologies for VADO zone treatment are standardized regardless of whether it's 1,4-dioxane being treated or another compound. These include excavation, thermal desorption, and solidification and stabilization. Both oxidant soil blending and extreme SVE are approaches identified as emerging options. Extreme SVE differs from conventional SVE in that it has a higher number of pore exchanges and uses heated air. There are a few less effective treatment technologies, including traditional SVE, bioventing, and biopiles. These aren't particularly effective due to the physical and chemical characteristics of 1,4-dioxane, as well as some of the limitations of most indigenous microorganisms. Now we'll switch gears into groundwater treatment. First, we'll talk about the source zone and treatment technologies that can be applied there. Just a reminder that these technologies can also be applied in the downgradient portion of the plume. They aren't meant to be limited only to source zone treatment. In situ thermal treatment can be used for 1,4-dioxane and may be particularly helpful when it's present in a chlorinated solvent source area. The boiling point of 1,4-dioxane is higher than the chlorinated solvents, and it doesn't volatilize as well at ambient temperatures. However, heating the subsurface can help increase 1,4-dioxane volatility, and if heated enough, it will boil off. Different types of thermal treatment can be applied, including electrical resistive heating, thermal conductive heating, and steam enhanced extraction. Each of these has their benefits and challenges. The biggest benefit of thermal treatment is that a large amount of mass can be removed over a short period of time, and that's why we're highlighting it for source zone treatment. In situ chemical oxidation is another commonly considered source area treatment. Different oxidants have varying strengths, as you can see from the list of standard oxidation potentials on the right-hand side. The larger table breaks down the common oxidants used to treat 1,4-dioxane, what their physical state typically is, how long they last in the subsurface, and their ability to be delivered to the subsurface via various methods. We've also tried to help identify which chemical species play a role in treatment for each chemical reagent using those very colorful shapes that you see. Persulfate is commonly used chemical oxidant for 1,4-dioxane treatment. It can be delivered as a liquid sodium persulfate solution or as solid potassium persulfate. Persulfate requires an activation step to generate the most powerful reactive species, and the activator chosen will dictate what reactive species are generated. Common activators include alkaline solution like sodium hydroxide, various forms of iron, hydrogen peroxide, and heat. Depending on how it's being activated, persulfate can be delivered to the subsurface via direct push methods, permanent injection wells, a slurry injection, or slow-release cylinders. Once there, persulfate can remain active in the subsurface on the order of weeks to months. If we hop down to the bottom of the table, we see that various forms of permanganate can be delivered to the subsurface in a similar manner and can also remain reactive for months. Moving up a row, modified Fenton's reagent is a liquid injection based on hydrogen peroxide that has a faster reaction time frame than persulfate or permanganate. And lastly, use of gas phase oxidants like ozone and peroxone also have a shorter reaction time frame, as well as different injection strategies since gas distribution is a key component. One of the reasons why persulfate is quite used frequently for 1,4-dioxane treatment is because it can generate some very reactive radical species, like the sulfate and hydroxyl radicals, both of which can react with 1,4-dioxane. Treatment of co-contaminants is also an important consideration, with chlorinated ethanes, such as TCA, being more difficult to treat than chlorinated ethenes. It's important to get the right oxidant dosing and activation method to get at those chlorinated ethanes. A lot of people start with bench testing for this reason. And just remember that while ISCO is commonly chosen as a source area treatment, it can also be applied further down gradient, perhaps in a permeable reactive barrier. A few other things to consider with ISCO. It has been described as a contact sport. In order for it to work, the oxidant needs to be in contact with the contaminant. Depending on the subsurface conditions, you may want to choose an oxidant that will stick around for months rather than weeks, and a delivery method that will get it where it needs to be in the subsurface. It's also important to understand the likelihood of the aquifer to back diffuse contaminants into groundwater after the oxidant has worn off. The natural water quality is also an important consideration for ISCO. Natural organic matter in the subsurface can scavenge the oxidant, meaning that higher dosing may be needed. Delivery of oxidant into the subsurface will temporarily change the redox conditions, which can lead to temporary metals mobilization. The type of oxidant used and the inherent subsurface conditions mean that various byproducts could form, some of which may be regulated themselves. These are just a few more reasons to consider bench testing prior to field application. And before we get off this topic, I do want to point out that we have an ISCO case study in the guidance document. In situ metabolic bioremediation can also be a useful tool in the toolbox, particularly for source area treatment. Typically, when we think of bioremediation, we're thinking about metabolic bio, i.e. bacteria that make a living consuming target contaminants. If we think about petroleum hydrocarbons for a second, these microorganisms use the hydrocarbons and oxygen to generate energy and new biomass. It's the same for 1,4-dioxane. There are a handful of microbes we know of to date that will utilize 1,4-dioxane and oxygen to generate energy and new biomass while leaving only carbon dioxide behind. Based on our current understanding, these are aerobic bacteria, and they prefer to metabolize 1,4-dioxane when high concentrations of 1,4-dioxane are present. That's why this approach may be of interest for source area treatment. Because 1,4-dioxane metabolizers prefer higher starting concentrations, it's important to understand whether there's enough 1,4-dioxane in the subsurface to support this type of treatment strategy. It may be tougher to implement at downgradient portions of the plume where 1,4-dioxane concentrations are lower. Additionally, oxygen needs to be present, so if it's not available naturally, then the treatment system will need to be engineered to deliver an adequate amount of oxygen into the groundwater. Like I mentioned before, we currently know of only a few types of microorganisms that can degrade 1,4-dioxane through metabolic processes, so bioaugmentation may be necessary if those microbes aren't present in the subsurface already. The last word of caution with this approach is that high concentrations of some chlorinated solvents and some metals could inhibit the microbe's ability to degrade the 1,4-dioxane. Now we'll move on to discussing technologies that are more commonly applied to the downgradient portion of the groundwater plume. These include both in situ and ex situ treatment technologies. Just a reminder that these technologies can also be applied to other portions of the plume. They aren't meant to be limited to downgradient treatment only. With that, we transition into a few in situ treatment technologies. We start with phytoremediation, which is a fully demonstrated technology that we happen to have a case study about in the guidance document. While there are several treatment mechanisms that may be at play for 1,4-dioxane treatment with phyto, phytoextraction is the dominant one at play for this compound. This is where 1,4-dioxane is pulled up through the roots of the tree and transpired into the atmosphere where it was destroyed by UV light. Phytoremediation is attractive because it's a relatively hands-off remedy and it benefits from the high solubility of 1,4-dioxane in water. However, phytoremediation can take longer than some other in situ technologies, and the presence of deeper groundwater requires special design considerations. Phytoremediation does require design, and some considerations are listed here. It's important to use the right plants for the region in which the project is located. Phytoremediation is best employed when groundwater is at a depth of 25 feet below ground surface or less, and when the 1,4-dioxane impacts are located within the top 5 feet of that groundwater. However, use of engineered phytoremediation systems like tree wells or solar-powered pumps can use to help with deeper groundwater. It's important to understand whether transpiration rate of the trees will be enough to counter the groundwater flux into the treatment area. This may start to dictate the number of trees needed and the potential spacing. And with that, I will transition over to Francisco to finish off the rest of the section.
Thank you very much, Fritz. Okay, so we already talked about metabolic bioremediation in the context of source area treatment strategies. Now we'll get into co-metabolic bioremediation as a strategy typically employed downgrading. In co-metabolic bioremediation, the microorganisms do not gain energy from using the 1,4-dioxane. In fact, it doesn't use the 1,4-dioxane at all. It uses a primary substrate coupled with oxygen to generate energy and biomass. There are lots of primary substrates that can be used, including many of the alkane gases like propane and ethane. And lucky for us, the enzymes that are produced as part of the process can also go on to degrade 1,4-dioxane, ultimately to carbon dioxide. They can also degrade other constituents of concern, like some chlorinated solvents. And one nice thing about co-metabolic bioremediation is that you don't have a concentration limitation like for metabolic bioremediation. All you really need is to have enough oxygen around, along with the primary substrate in the same place as the 1,4-dioxane. So when engineering this type of treatment system, there are too few moving parts to consider. For example, enough oxygen and primary substrate need to be delivered to the subsurface, typically through sparging or gas-saturated water. There is a catch-22, though, where you don't want to give them too much of the primary substrate because then the enzymes won't have a chance to go on to degrade the 1,4-dioxane. So it's a bit of a balance. Also, many of these primary substrates are flammable gases. Therefore, delivery systems need to be built with extra controls in place. The right microbes need to be present to do the work, and bioaugmentation may be needed. They also likely need to have some micronutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus so that they will need to be also delivered to the subsurface. And like I mentioned before, co-metabolic biodegradation can work for any starting concentration of 1,4-dioxane, as has been shown to decrease concentrations to below 1 microgram per liter. It can also be used to degrade chlorinated compounds, but there's a warning that high enough concentrations of some chlorinated compounds can actually inhibit biodegradation. We do have a fun case study that tracks this approach from bench scale testing all the way to full scale operation. So when thinking about the attenuation processes relevant to 1,4-dioxane, it's, oh, I'm sorry, I think I am one slide, there you go. When thinking about the attenuation process relevant to 1,4-dioxane, it's important to remind that 1,4-dioxane has a low Henry's law constant and a low KUC value. That means that volatilization and sorption to soil may not be the dominant attenuation mechanisms. Really, the relevant attenuation mechanisms for 1,4-dioxane include dilution, diffusion, and biodegradation. And we've talked a lot about biodegradation in engineered systems, but now we're talking about natural systems. And luckily, we have both the metabolic and co-metabolic pathways available to us. And in either case, the right microorganisms need to be present and oxygen needs to be present as well. If we're evaluating the co-metabolic pathway, then a primary substrate also needs to be present. Likewise, we need to make sure that there aren't levels of chlorinated solvents or metals present that could inhibit natural biodegradation. These are all the types of things that we'll want to look for as part of a natural attenuation evaluation. And luckily for us, there's a growing arsenal of advanced analytical tools that we can use to evaluate natural attenuation mechanisms. These are similar to the tools that we use for evaluating other compounds like chlorinated solvents, but have been tailored to 1,4-dioxane. First up are the geochemical parameters. These can be used to confirm whether aerobic conditions are present and if primary substrates are present that could foster co-metabolic biodegradation. Next, we move on to the microbial analysis. These include things like genetic targets designed to evaluate metabolic biodegradation of 1,4-dioxane, as well as targets designed to evaluate co-metabolic biodegradation. And last is compound-specific isotope analysis. This is an analytical method that can demonstrate evidence of biodegradation, but it has its limitations, particularly when lower concentrations of 1,4-dioxane are present. And also a word of warning, as an industry, we're still developing these tools and learning how to best apply them to evaluate natural attenuation of 1,4-dioxane. Now, before we talk about some of the ex situ treatment technologies that are less effective against 1,4-dioxane, I do want to remind you about some of the critical characteristics of 1,4-dioxane. In particular, a reminder that 1,4-dioxane has a low Henry's law constant, so it does not volatilize from water very much. And also, it has a low KOC value, which means that it doesn't readily adsorb to carbon. We want to mention some of the less effective in situ treatment technologies. Again, it's important to know that these technologies may still result in some treatment of 1,4-dioxane, but they aren't expected to meet the targets over reasonable timeframes. These technologies are commonly applied to chlorinated solvent plumes, so it's important to understand the limitations for 1,4-dioxane treatment. The low volatility of 1,4-dioxane makes air sparge and SVE approaches less effective. Zero-valent iron may have some benefit in treating 1,4-dioxane, but studies conducted to date indicate that the timeframes for these may be longer than desired. And we just spent some time talking about aerobic biodegradation of 1,4-dioxane. It's important to note that anaerobic bioremediation strategies have not been shown to have the same success. This is important because things like carbon substrate injection is very common for treatment of chlorinated solvents. Similar to ISCO being a solid option for 1,4-dioxane treatment in situ, advanced oxidation processes, or AOPs, are a commonly implemented approach for ex situ treatment. Now, again, similar to ISCO, different oxidants used in AOPs have varying amounts of destructive capability. You'll notice that most of the AOPs listed on this table utilize ultraviolet light in combination with various oxidants and/or catalysts to generate reactive species. All of these AOPs can effectively destroy 1,4-dioxane and chlorinated ethenes. However, those that use ozone and hydrogen peroxide can also destroy some of the chlorinated ethanes that may also be present. AOPs are typically used in conjunction with pump and treat systems, and this can include groundwater extraction and treatment in the very classical sense or in a more dynamic recirculation approach. Well, some of the considerations for AOPs are similar to ISCO, some are different. AOPs are known for being energy intensive and may require large use of chemical oxidants. Similar to ISCO, matrix diffusion can play a role in concentration rebound, particularly for more traditional PNT configurations. The characteristics of the influent water are also very important to understand. It may be necessary to include other treatment processes before or after the AOP system to address things like natural occurring iron or generation of bromate. AOPs can readily scale up or down and can be retrofitted onto existing pump and treat systems if 1,4-dioxane is found to be present after initial design. We have a great case study in the guidance document about how impacted groundwater can lead drinking water providers augment existing systems with an AOP to treat 1,4-dioxane. Now switching to bioreactors. Bioreactors are an emerging option being considered for ex-situ treatment. Metabolic bioreactors build off of the same process as we discussed for in-situ metabolic bioremediation. They can be useful when 1,4-dioxane concentrations are high and require the presence of oxygen and the right microorganisms. While there have been lab and pilot scale demonstration, our team wasn't aware of full scale application of this type of approach yet. However, co-metabolic bioreactors have been used at both the lab scale and full scale. And we'll learn more about co-metabolic bioremediation. But in summary, the microbes, like I mentioned, they need to have a substrate provided in order to grow. The bioreactor treating the landfill leachate at the Lowry landfill is probably the longest running co-metabolic bioreactor treating 1,4-dioxane in the presence of tetrahydrofuran. So there are several things to consider when designing a bioreactor system to treat 1,4-dioxane. The concentration of 1,4-dioxane present, the effluent treatment requirements, and the potential presence of co-contaminants that may guide the decision of whether to design a metabolic or co-metabolic bioreactor. The necessary treatment flow rates and hydraulic rotation times may indicate the type of bioreactor configuration chosen. It may be necessary to deliver oxygen, nutrients, or a primary substrate into the bioreactor. And lastly, seeding with the right microbial community and establishment and proliferation of that community is key to maintaining the effectiveness of the bioreactor. We've already learned that 1,4-dioxane has a low sorption coefficient. This means that under many circumstances, most sorbents are not particularly effective at removing 1,4-dioxane. However, there is a sorptive resin specifically designed to better remove 1,4-dioxane from water. AmberSorb has been applied at full scale, and we have a case study about that in the guidance document. As with any sorbent design, the size of the bezels, the number of the bezels, hydraulic rotation time, and the breakthrough monitoring all need to be specifically designed to tight conditions. One of the benefits of AmberSorb is that it can be regenerated using steam. However, then the 1,4-dioxane needs to be treated in that waste stream. So as with other sorbent technologies, you only remove 1,4-dioxane from water, you don't destroy it. Now, with that in mind, we did want to touch on some of the less effective ex-situ treatment technologies, mostly because these technologies are commonly employed for treatment of other compounds, including dechlorinated solvents that 1,4-dioxane make be co-located with. Note that while these technologies might be less effective at removing 1,4-dioxane from water, there may still be upwards of 50% removal when these technologies are applied. Air stripping is one of that technologies that is commonly used to remove chlorinated solvents from water, but won't remove much of 1,4-dioxane at the same time. Ion exchange and reverse osmosis are technologies that haven't shown high 1,4-dioxane removal due to the size and charge of the molecule. Liquid phase granular activated carbon is another technology commonly used to remove chlorinated solvents from water. But due to the 1,4-dioxane's low sorption coefficient, use of LGAC it needs to be specifically designed to monitor for 1,4-dioxane breakthrough. It may not be feasible at high flow rates, but it may have an application for residential treatment. So now we're going to shift gears one last time to our last topic, which is drinking water and wastewater treatment. Because 1,4-dioxane has made its way into many drinking water sources, and because it's present in many personal care products, it's important to consider how well it's treated using conventional drinking water and wastewater treatment processes. As shown in these very simplified flow diagrams, drinking water and wastewater treatment plants conventionally rely on physical removal of constituents with some focused biological treatment. As we talked about today, the physical chemical properties of 1,4-dioxane mean that it doesn't readily volatilize or sorb the particles that might be removed via these processes. While disinfection processes employ oxidative processes, these aren't typically strong enough to destroy 1,4 dioxane. Therefore, it's common to see something like only 50 to 70% maximum removal of 1,4 dioxane through a drinking water or wastewater treatment plant. In some cases, as is now happening on Long Island, this may not be enough. In these cases, there are advanced treatment options that can be employed to remove 1,4 dioxane from water from the water stream. Many of these are similar to the ex situ treatment technologies we discussed earlier, such as AOPs. The last topic to cover is related to drinking water treatment, to discuss the residential drinking water treatment. Like we mentioned when discussing activated carbon treatment, if designed properly, LGAC can be effective for residential drinking water treatment. Several LGAC vessels can be staged in a basement or a shed to treat all of the water entering the house, and breakthrough monitoring and changeouts should be scheduled to maintain a high level of security that clean water is being provided. Note that things like small carbon filters for pitchers in refrigerators or faucets do not provide the same level of protection. Likewise, commonly used particulate filters, water softening devices, and UV disinfection systems will not adequately remove 1,4 dioxane from water before use. So in summary, there are many options for 1,4 dioxane treatment of soils or vapor, groundwater, drinking water, and wastewater. Different options should be applied under different situations, and selection should be based on site-specific information. Don't forget that there are several technologies that are used for treatment of other common compounds, like chlorinated solvents, that aren't as effective at treatment 1,4 dioxane. And we hope that this presentation was helpful in providing an overview of 1,4 dioxane treatment technologies. And please remember that you can visit the web-based 1,4 dioxane guidance document for more details on all of these technologies. Thank you very much.
Francisco and Fritz for the that last module. It's 2:59, so we're going to jump right into our final Q&A session here, and I'll look to the Q&A pod for any questions for our trainers, and then we'll wrap up the training today. So our first question, how many duplicates in MS/MSDs are recommended for sampling?
Okay, I'll take that. It's Liz. So there aren't any requirements on this. It's usually regulatory driven, but you know, basic industry practices, duplicates are typically one per 10 samples, and MSMSDs are one per every 20 samples per matrix for both of them.
Wonderful. Next question. How concerned should I be about 1,4 dioxane being in my shampoo, detergent, soap, cosmetics, and baby products?
Hi, this is Janet. I can probably try to attempt that. I mean, so EPA has evaluated some what they call conditions of use for consumer exposure results. Notably, they looked at like dishwasher detergent, dish soap, laundry detergent, those types of products that have potential to have the higher levels of 1,4 dioxane. In all of these types of products, most manufacturers have reduced their potential generation of 1,4 dioxane by changing their manufacturing process. So that's really all we can say is that the levels either are eliminated or have been going down, and EPA has made the decision that there's no unreasonable risk, but again, specific to just the few items that they had data to evaluate that include things like dish soap and laundry detergent. So I hope that's helpful.
Thank you, Janet. Next question. Are there metals other than copper two that can inhibit biodegradation of 1,4 dioxane with CV1190? Primarily thinking of byproducts of degradation of CVOCs, for example, iron, Mn, et cetera. I can't remember the element for Mn right now.
Fritz, I don't know if you want to go first or.
Sure. Manganese is the other metal referred to there. And yes, the person asking the question, copper can be inhibitory as laboratories studies have demonstrated. Also, some studies have found that iron or manganese could potentially be synergistic, so that more elevated concentrations of those, at least up into a point, could provide some benefit for 1,4-dioxane degradation by some bacteria. I don't recall if that study was CB1190 or something slightly different. Additionally, there's also been some studies that have found that byproducts of chlorinated solvent, reductive dechlorination, ethene, ethane could theoretically be a co-metabolite that could result in some 1,4-dioxane biodegradation. So there's a few theoretical side processes where anaerobic conditions could benefit aerobic biodegradation of 1,4-dioxane. The rub there, though, is you have to have the oxygen. So this would have to happen, you know, someplace somewhat distant from where the anaerobic bio is occurring.
Yes, and just to add to your response, I believe that, I'm not sure if it's Shaili Mahendra out of UCLA that published a paper on inhibition coefficients for CB1190, which is a metabolic bacteria. If it's not her, there must be somebody who already looked into metals inhibition on biodegradation rates. So yes, some of the metals will have some inhibitory effects. But like Fritz mentioned, there could also be byproducts that are beneficial.
All right, thank you, Fritz and Francisco. Next question. Have you evaluated the ratio of primary substrate to dioxane to promote co-metabolic biodegradation?
Yeah, I can try to answer that as well. I personally have run experiments with primary substrates for co-metabolic degradation of 1,4-dioxane. And yes, there is an optimum ratio that has to do with the kinetics of the bacteria degrading that primary substrate. And you do want to reach to a point where you don't have elevated primary substrate concentrations all the time, and you let the bacteria allow switch to utilize whatever enzymes they produce to tackle 1,4-dioxane. So, but I would say it will be, to my knowledge, it will be specific to the bacteria cultures that you have in play, unless anybody else here in the group knows of some rules of thumb for those ratios, stoichiometric ratios.
Thank you. Next question. 1,4-dioxane oxidation via chlorine in drinking and wastewater treatment plants. Do you know if this is a possibility?
Well, I'll try to answer that. And Fritz, I don't know if you can weigh in, but to my knowledge, I'm not aware of chlorine being an oxidant powerful enough to degrade 1,4-dioxane. And I think, as we mentioned, you really have to have a high power oxidant, and sometimes in combination with other catalysts or sources of energy. And I'm not sure if perhaps in combination with UV or sonication or other things it can happen. But Fritz, do you know of any cases with chlorine?
I do not, no.
All right. Thank you, Francisco. Next question. Do you have any experience with carbon for residential poet drinking water treatment?
I'll speak to that one briefly. We have a case study in the guidance document that is exactly that, a residential point of use system. And as we were putting this together some years ago, you know, we were trying to couple the theory where, hey, activated carbon doesn't really work that well with someone having successfully done this at a small residential system. So we think the difference there was the flow rates, the residence time in this particular situation. As for the cost effectiveness, it was an adjacent RP that was paying for it. So we don't know what the costs were exactly. I don't recall the specifics, but it was a change out frequency that seemed reasonable enough. They weren't changing the carbon on a weekly basis or anything like that. It was maybe annual or so. Take a look at the case study in the tech reg, please.
All right. Thank you, Fritz. Next question. We've seen a real-world lack of effectiveness at treating 1,4-dioxane using traditional GAC. Has LGAC been demonstrated as a cost-effective treatment method for small-scale, for example, maybe residential, point-of-entry treatment for 1,4-dioxane?
And I think that the response to the previous question would probably hold for that as well. Take a look at what we have there in the tech reg. If you still have questions, you could reach out to one of us, and we might have a few more details on that. But the small systems seem to be the sweet spot for that, if in fact there is such a thing.
All right, that concludes our question and answer portion of the training here. So I will send us away with just some few logistical notes. We would love to hear back from you today on our training through the feedback form. I did put the link in the chat for everybody, and that's also going to be how you receive a certificate of completion if you're interested in one of those. If you also would like any further clarification, or if you have any additional questions that you would like to ask our trainers, feel free to get in touch with us at itrc@itrcweb.org. You're also welcome to get in touch with our trainers directly. Their contact information is listed on the Clewin training page that brought you here today. I'll put this our email in the chat for everybody as well. But with that, I would like to just say a big thank you to our volunteer trainers for being here today and supporting this training. And another special thank you to our attendees for taking the time to spend with us during this training. We hope to see you in a future ITRC training event, and please let us know if there's anything we can do for you in the meantime. With that, everybody have a wonderful rest of your day. And again, thank you so much, trainers.